Hello everyone, John Aldridge here with Aldo Meets, episode 14 already. As you know, we've been delighted to have some great guests over the last year or so. And I've got another one, a special one, in my old mate, Robbie Fowler, who's nicknamed God. For one reason, because he is God. How are you, pal?
I'm good, mate. I have been called worse, by the way.
No, you missed so me, no, mate, yeah. And also, we've got Peter Shriversman and James Pierce, obviously, the host to join us. Anyway, without any more of that shite, how's the things, Rob? How's the golf? What are you up to? Tell everyone, mate.
Yeah, so what am I up to now? Yeah, you know what? Just plodding along, trying to get back into football. I mean, you've just said, how's the golf? The golf is probably getting worse, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. No, that's not true.
Yeah, no, it actually is. I actually have gone up, but I mean, my love's footy. I want to get back into that as soon as possible. I'm just waiting for an opportunity.
Do you know what? We've talked over the years, haven't we? I think, like, for whatever reason, Robbie hasn't been given an opportunity, you know, and what he's actually been. And, you know, you talk about apprenticeships and learning things, and he's been there all over the place and seen it in different countries and whatever. And it just astounds me that you haven't. I know you might be waiting for the right club, but, you know, like a sleeping giant, obviously, like Rooney's just gone to Plymouth, which is a bit of a sleeping giant, you know. It's, you know, but for some reason, he hasn't had a little bit of luck, which, I'm not just saying because he's a friend, that he deserves, you know.
Yeah, I mean, can I just obviously just add to that? You know, I'm not waiting for a club, the right club, you know. I'm waiting for a club per se. So, you know, I'm not, I don't think I'm too big to go into a club who've got potential. You know, it's not me waiting for suddenly this club is going to go everywhere. I'm waiting for obviously the right club, but, you know, it'll be nice to have a conversation. Obviously, my route into obviously football management is maybe a lot different. I'm probably the most experienced manager, if that makes sense, because I've had four spells overseas. I wanted to go and do overseas because it was sort of taking me from the comfort zone. You know, we hear a lot in this country about people saying, oh, you know, he's gone that job and he's not earned the accolades, or he's not earned the right to go manage this club. I want to go abroad and show everyone that I was, you know, willing to go out of my comfort zone, and show people how dedicated and how much I wanted to do it. And I think it sort of backfired on me a little bit, because it's that out of sight, out of mind thing. So, you know, and it is what it is, and people can obviously make their own assumptions of why you haven't got here or why I haven't got there. I've tried to get into a few places, obviously none as yet. But my record's been very, very good, you know, and without obviously giving myself a real pat on the back, you know, I've been rightly proud of what I've done and the job I've done at every club I've been at. So, again, it's just a case of let's wait for something to crop up, and I'm confident of certainly taking a club into the realms of being successful again or even growing a club.
Well, you've got time on your hands because you're relatively young where managers are concerned. Anyway, you just need that little bit of luck, you know. Anyone out there, you know, he's your man, all right?
Listen to Aldo. he knows stuff.
Robbie, it's coming up to a year since you left Saudi. Is it Al Qadzia? Is that how you
call it? Qadzia, yeah.
Qadzia. I mean, you won 6 and drew 2 out of 8 league games. It, from the outside, it looked like a very strange decision. What exactly went on there?
Yeah, I actually thought it was a strange decision, full stop. And look, you know, I don't really know what's gone on behind the scenes in terms of the upper echelons of the club.
Yeah.
But we had a Spanish sporting director who I just think wanted to go down the route of having a Spanish flavour at the club. So I've got no qualms with that. You know, it's their club and they can really do what they want. But I'd heard for a while that they were trying to sort of get rid of me, in all fairness. And I think the timing of obviously my departure of Qadzia was probably, we played all the tougher games, and it sounds stupid because it was early in the season, but we played all the tough games and we were good, we were solid, we were comfortable. And then we had a relatively run of a relatively easy run of playing all the weaker teams. So I just felt that was the time that he probably needed to get rid, because it probably would have looked worse if I would won a lot more games. Yeah. So I mean, the record over there was brilliant. And you know, you've mentioned obviously league games and obviously cup games. I mean, we had lots of friendlies as well. I mean, when we got together in pre-season, it was tough because we didn't have the foreign players per se. We had obviously all the local players. And this was a team that was in the, well, you know, they were in the first division of Saudi, and they were close to getting relegated to the second division. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine the players, and without sounding obviously horrible here or disrespectful, the players probably weren't good enough. And obviously, get come in, you know, we have this pre-season, and it was essentially like going for, you know, like you remember going for trials for old schoolboys, where you've got like a clipboard, and So I mean, we could have done that with a lot of the players, but we went and we done well in pre-season in terms of getting everyone, you know, galvanizing together. You know, we lost a few games in pre-season, which is understandable. But then we started the game, the start of the season, and you know, obviously with international breaks, we arranged friendlies, you know, little trips here and there, and you know, we were unbeaten for a long, long time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, my time there was brilliant. I loved the place. Genuinely thought it was brilliant.
Did you enjoy living over there?
Yeah, loved it. Yeah. And look, you know, we all understand human rights issues, and you know what people have. I mean, I'm not here for the politics about, you know, football, but, you know, I was over there to play football to manage a football team and do the very best I could do. Yeah, and I done that. But the place was okay. You know, it was okay that there was some good people there. But I think there's some sneaky people. But that could be anywhere, as you said. But, I mean, I can sort of sit here today and talk about sort of how well I done for the club, and obviously the club progressed and won the league. I mean, I had a few chats with the sporting director who wanted to play off, you know, a certain formation, and I was set in the ways I wanted. Not, I don't mean that in an horrible way where I wasn't prepared to listen, because you know, I want to understand the game. I want to understand what people's opinions and views are of how you can play and what you can play. But I felt the best way for us to grow as a club was to play this formation. And obviously, I think that was maybe one of the reasons the club wanted to play another way. And obviously, when I went, they changed the formation. And out of the 20 games, they lost 8 games in the remainder of the season. And how they got promoted at the end, towards the end of the season, they went back to the way we were playing at the start. So, you know, fundamentally, so my way of playing was absolutely spot on, and the club, you know, they went back to you know, to type, didn't they?
Yeah, we've obviously seen a lot of top players go across to the Saudi Pro League. It seems like it's not just a flash in the pan. Do you get the impression they are really serious about growing that league, so it is a real competitor?
Yeah, I think so. And look, you know, obviously I should be sat here absolutely condemning everyone, you know, over there, and you know, for the way sort of I felt I was maybe sort of lambasted at the club. But again, you know, I want to speak really, really, you know, positively about my experience over there. The players and the league want to compete with the best, and I've no doubt that they will do. You know, and look, it's not going to be a click of the fingers, and you know, all of a sudden we're going to be the number one league in the world. They have a plan. You know, the plan is to be, you know, a competitive league and probably be in the top maybe 10 within 5 years, and they'll do it. You know, and our seer is probably no different than what the Premier League done. So when the Premier League started, the Premier League had these big, you know, hopes and ambitions of getting to be the best league in the world, because obviously the old league wasn't, was it? Mm. If we're being honest. Mm. But players came here, you know, the Premier League spent money, clubs end up spending money, bringing all the best players over here, and then all of a sudden the growth and the, you know, the standard of the league became better. Mm. And it's no different to what Saudi are doing now. You know,
same sort of plan, isn't it? Yeah.
And Robbie, before we move on to some of your earlier managerial destinations, I'm just very curious, how did you find the lifestyle out there? I was lucky enough once to go from Kuwait to Dammam to watch one of Stevie's games.
Yeah.
And although the experience was great, but I think it was something like 9 p.m., 41 degrees, 75% humidity.
Yeah.
You looked at Jordan Henderson and he was absolutely drenched before the first whistle went. So how did you find the conditions in that sense and then your lifestyle out there?
Conditions, yes. I think that is, it's something you get used to. Mm. Look, it's not ideal and it's not, you know, in keeping how we want to see the best football games. But what I will say is, you know, people adapt and people will grow into sort of that environment. Conditions wise, you know, it's one of the issues that people say, you don't get many people in the crowds or, you know, in the ground, sorry, that the crowds are sort of very sparse. Mm-hmm. When the big teams play, I'm telling you that the country stops and stands still and everyone's sort of intrigued with how this, mm-hmm. this game will play. So you've probably got four or five top teams, when they play, I mean, everyone's talking about them and the stadiums will be full. One of the problems that you have is, again, it's like a bit of a propaganda issue where people go, oh, the league's this, the league's that, and then they'll show you, you know, camera angles of the stadium or the stadia. Now, one of the problems that you do have, and it will change because, you know, by all accounts, they're going to, you know, try everything to get to the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So the stadium will need to improve. And I think that, for me, is one of the problems that they've got. And it's because of that reason, you don't see the full crowds all the time. Because you've just mentioned it, you know, it's 8 p.m., 9 p.m., mm-hmm. it's still 41 degrees, and it's too warm mm-hmm. to sit in the stadium.
I sat there, and I didn't move, and it was literally running down me. It is not a very enjoyable experience.
I mean, I hope it was sweaty tonight.
But
I mean, look, that's how I see it, you know, to be fair. And I think that's the propaganda issue. So when it is, you know, 30, 40 degrees, it's hard for people to go and sit in a stadium and just, like, you know, silly. And yeah, that's why you can't have games in the afternoon, because it's just generally too hot.
Yeah.
It's just too warm. And stadiums will change, you know, it will get cooler. We've seen it in Qatar with the air conditioning.
They'll
have that in Saudi, and when you see that, you know, the crowds will be, they'll go because they are massively interested in football. They really are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, looking at the other places you've been in the past, it seems like the weather must have been a key factor in your decision making. I mean, 2011, Thailand, Muang Thong United.
Muang Thong, yeah.
How was that experience?
Again, loved it. And you know what? I think everywhere I've been, I've enjoyed it because I've wanted to go and do it. And I've wanted to, again, it's go out of that comfort zone and show people.
Sure.
I'm one of them, whereas when I go places, you know, whether it's, you're going to have your drink with your mates or whatever, it's going, you go to a family party, I want to embrace everything and I want to do everything that's right. So, I mean, that's my sort of, my drive into football clubs and countries. Okay, I've been to India, Thailand, you know, Australia, and Saudi, but I've wanted to embrace the culture. I've wanted to embrace what, you know, people make a big thing about culture, you know, in terms of, you know, going into India. I mean, India was tough because it was COVID. We were based in the hotel. We couldn't leave the hotel other than to play games and train. I think we might have to have another podcast to talk about that one, because that is, I mean, that is a long story.
Can we schedule that today?
So in Thailand, you know, the culture is obviously, players are different. You know, we had players who would sleep on the floor because that was what they were used to. You know, having curry for a pre-match meal, stopping off in temples before games, because that was the culture. But I think what we fundamentally need to remember is football's got a culture as well. So as much as you've got to understand and appreciate their culture, players from, you know, whatever country you're at, got to understand the culture of football. So as much as we understand and do everything right in terms of trying to be better, listening to them and listening to the culture that people have, but, you know, we've got to understand that you've got to listen to coaches, managers, you know, CEOs, chairman, owners about the culture of football, because, you know, it ultimately, that is the game, isn't it?
I'm just thinking, I love curry, but I couldn't see myself having a vindaloo at 12 o'clock before I'm playing Everton. your stomach, and now before kickoff's giving it you a bit of bifters, but imagine having a vindaloo. doesn't go well, does it?
In most podcasts, John tells us all about how culturally different things were for him when he went to Spain, right?
Yeah.
That was quite a big change for you. But the places that you've been gives you like a mega wide understanding of how different areas of the world work and the people. Yeah. I mean, surely that's a selling point for you, right? That cultural awareness.
Absolutely. And look, it'll be interesting to see what Aldo says here, by the way, because, you know, as much as we're brought up in this country about, you know, having your pastas, your rice, you know, your chickens, you know, your meat to try and bring protein, I bet you years ago in Spain, I bet you were having paella, weren't you, with like all, you know, I mean, that's just like...
When I went to Spain, I couldn't believe how advanced they were within that department, you know what I mean, the eating, you know, before games, the night before, you know, the day of a game. Even when you were traveling, all that, it was so scientific compared to when we were on a Friday before playing a Saturday, we're having Scotch pies and beans. Gorgeous, don't get me wrong. Beans are all right. Scotch pie, I'm not too sure, with brown sauce all over it and all that. But it was what it was. And then of a match day, you'd have like chicken or, to be fair, Rushy and Barnes used to have the biggest fucking steak I've ever seen.
Can you swear on here, by the way? I had to buy me a tongue before you talking about like curries. And I mean, you've got a shitty ass at the best of times.
We had the biggest steaks at 12 o'clock before probably when you blame was still the same, you know. And half a chicken in the Holiday Inn, half a chicken would be roasted chicken, not full chicken. But look, and then rice pudding afterwards if you wanted it. But that's what we're Liverpool where I'm not the slipper, everyone.
Even like the night before, you mentioned Rushy having steak at a pre-match, but having steak and chips the night before. Yeah. Even at the games, I mean, Ronnie Moran would come round on the team bus and say, what do you want? Chicken, fish, or pie, wasn't it?
And
your dad come. And remember stopping off at a chippy on the way home after the game. The first chippy, the nearest chippy to the ground. And Elmer would come out with it, obviously.
Big Elmer was our coach driver.
And all this came with chips, by the way. And I don't really know where I put it, you know what I mean?
And it's, you know what? It's lovely, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It always seems to be better after games.
It's lovely, you'd have a few cans of lager as well in the fridge and all, is all right.
And a Carlsberg one in the fridge, yeah.
And you mentioned before the time in Australia. I mean, when you took over at Brisbane, I think they finished second bottom the year before. You took them to fourth place before the pandemic struck. I mean, it was obviously a disappointing end the way it petered out. But you, like, again, it was a successful period, wasn't it, in terms of transforming their fortunes?
And look, I said before how proud I am about everywhere I've been to. Again, I want to go out of comfort zone. I know I've mentioned this, but I went over to Australia because it was my first real chance. You know, obviously I'd been in Thailand, but, you know, I'd been back over here wanting to do all my coaching badges, and I've got everything now, you know. I've got obviously the pro license. I just completed the diploma in football management as well. So I wanted to do all them. So I went obviously to Australia. So the team was, I mean, they finished second bottom, did concede 77 goals, 77 or 78 goals in, I think, 28 games. Which is horrendous. So people think me playing the way I played, I'm going to be like really offensive, but, you know, I'm stupid enough to build teams, you know. And straight away, you know, this needs to stop. We need to build from the back, you know, try and be defensively solid, you know, and try and sort of wake up the pitch in terms of controlling areas of that middle of the pitch, and then having the correct, you know, firepower up top. And it was something that, again, I was rightly proud of, you know. We were third in the league. COVID struck. Obviously, I had to come home. I ended up losing my job because of COVID. So I think if it wasn't for COVID, I mean, I think I'd probably be managing Liverpool by now, I think. But, I mean, I was just obviously so happy with the trajectory I was going.
Yeah.
Proud of the way we played. Proud of the way I changed, again, a culture of a club who was shipping goals left, right and centre and getting beat, you know. I mean, by silly score lines. And obviously, when I left, we had the most clean sheets. We had, obviously, the best goalkeeper in the league, because he obviously never conceded. Defensively, we were rock solid. And I mean, it's hypothetical, but I think we have probably three games to go. I mean, I won manager a month in
January and
February, and I think I was due to get it in March as well, just before the So you know, we were by far the form team of the league, and again, I mean, who knows what might have happened, but I was confident of us going on to actually win the thing.
You mentioned obviously you've done all your coaching badges, you've travelled around the world, got this experience, but a football league club hasn't given you that opportunity yet. Do you think that is partly, do you think there's an unfair perception that maybe some football club owners or CEOs have going back to your playing days? Do you think that is?
Maybe. Look, and I can't answer that. You know, I think it's better for other people to answer that. What you see with me is obviously not necessarily what you get. You know, I'm so different to what people's perception and public opinion of me is. You know, and all I will tell you, I mean, I hope he tells you anyway. So. But when, look, you know,
can't count on Aldo. Yeah. I mean, seriously, all depends if he had his CBD this morning or not. Yeah.
But I'm one of them. Look, you know, I think, okay, look, I've done stupid things on a football pitch, you know, and obviously celebrated, you know, trying to take the piss out of people. And look, you know, it's wrong, you know, don't get me wrong. And it's not something that I've ever sort of put my hand up and say, I know it's the right thing to do. I know that that's probably the wrong, but I go into a football club and I think if you've got a dressing room full of robots, then it's probably not a dressing room I want to be in. Mm-hmm. So I think you need maybe characters in a dressing room to sort of lighten the atmosphere up and make things better. You know, if we sort of all here and we're all talking robotic, no one wants to listen.
Yeah.
But if you're here, you're being honest and you're sort of having a laugh, it drives people together, you know, and then there's more togetherness. Yeah. And my realms of getting into football was I wanted to be part of a dressing room that, you know, we had a laugh, but we had a laugh in the right way.
Yeah.
And that's probably what people think of me all the time. You're happy and you're jovial all the time.
Yeah.
But when it becomes, you know,
and it's serious.
Yeah, when you've got to be serious. I mean, there was no one more dedicated than me at doing the right things. And I genuinely will stick by that. So look, again, so I don't know why people haven't took a chance.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying took a chance because, you know, you're not taking a chance. You know, you, if you get me, then you'd be more than happy because I'm so confident in what I can do. I'm confident of growing clubs. I'm confident of creating the environment where players and even your staff can prosper and grow. And again, you know, I wait, but people's perception, it may be. I don't know the definitive answer.
Yeah. How does it work? When jobs come up, say in, I don't know, League One, League Two, are you putting your CV in? Is it just word of mouth that you just let someone know that you'd be interested?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't got an agent per se, whereas I'll obviously have a group of people, if you like, will put me in. And I don't, that might be the wrong thing to do. I don't know. You know, I never had an agent when I was playing. You know, maybe I should go down the route. But look, again, I'll plod along. I'll do what I need to do and I'll wait for this opportunity. And I will get one, you know, because I mean, I'll knock doors down. I have put my name in for other jobs. I threw my CVs in. I mean, I've had some probably not great replies back. I won't mention who, but you know, I've had obviously people ignore them. But my theory or way into football is, look, you know, if you've got someone and you're going to speak to a, you know, a club and someone, again, not sounding big headed here, but if I put my CV in, just have a chat.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
If you don't like me after a chat, then fair enough. But if you just sort of maybe throw my CV away or, you know, throw my number away just because I don't like him. But then, I mean, that's wrong. And football should never be like that. Just have a chat, you know, and I can talk to you about my, you know, my philosophy, my remit, my, you know, my ways of creating the, you know, the correct atmosphere and environment that clubs can grow. Because what will it be? It'll be, you know, 20, 30 minutes maximum.
Yeah. I hate ignorance ignorant people. And anything that, you know, deserves a little telephone call or just thanks very much, but, you know, or yes or no. Cost nothing.
Yeah.
Cost absolutely nothing. Probably spot on there.
And I'm not being of, you know, listen, come and talk to me. You know what I mean? Obviously, it's their own choice and, you know, we can live with that. But, you know, it is the case of pick up a phone and if you don't like me after that, yeah. It's absolutely fair play.
Just
and
I've got no problem with that. Yeah.
Just before the end of the first part of our podcast, you know, you are alluding to your style being not just like the team, but also creating an environment where the club improves and changes and so on. So with that in mind, there's a few managers that might spring to mind from which you might get some inspiration. But which was the manager that you played for that sort of that you learned most from, maybe with this in mind?
You know what? I don't think I've learned more from one. I think I've learned from every single one, if I'm being honest. And I think that's probably the beauty of me. I'm clever when it comes to football. So, you know, I can take things in. I mean, I'm big on man management. I genuinely believe if you're a great man manager, the players will run a little bit more for you.
I think this day and age as well, you know, you become more of a counsellor. You know, that's... I was more what Robbie's saying, that was down my roots as well.
Yeah.
You know, knowing the players, you know, one on one. You know what I mean? What he needs and what he needed and what he man management. And inspiring them, giving them the confidence and motivation.
Yeah.
You know. But everything you've said that you know you're spot on. So carry on.
So I'm just talking about there about obviously my managers I played under. I think, look, you know, I played under managers who were technically brilliant, tactically brilliant. And obviously my management style have been brilliant. Not all of them, admittedly, and not all of them being technically, tactically brilliant. But I think you could maybe take something from every manager. I mean, I love Graeme Souness for giving me my chance. And, you know, for his man managing me as a young team, getting into the team was exceptional. You know, you go on over, obviously, God rest his soul, Gerard Houllier, technically, tactically, was brilliant. Rafa Benitez, technically, tactically, was unbelievable. Maybe a little bit cold, and I don't mean that in an horrible way, I just mean that in like so straight laced in terms of, you know, football. And it was just solely football. But my favourite manager was Roy Evans. I genuinely love Roy Evans because. I don't know whether it was an old Liverpool trait, but his theory and his remit about life at Liverpool was, look, you know, if you go out there and play the way you can, people will sit up and take notice and people will fear you. And so we went into games like confident of what we could do because Roy gave us this unbelievable, you know, amount of confidence to go out there and play the way you can. Whereas... football changes, and I think nowadays you look at games and you look at managers and they all come in and they do, you know, video or do analysis on the opposition. And I think that is a must now. I genuinely think it is. But there's also something to say, well, look, we've got to sort of analyse what we do best as well, you know, as a football team and what you do best as a football player, because this is what you need to do. So you can go and analyse the opposition, but if you don't play the way you can, then... I think that's just irrelevant. Mm. So if you go and play the way you can and do that, then you sort of go into that game more confidence. Whereas back to if you're, analysing some teams and you put this video session on about, you know, and again, no disrespect to the likes of the Coventry, Southamptons and, you know, teams like that. I mean, as Liverpool players, we should be beating them. Or as Liverpool Football Club, we should be beating them. Then all of a sudden, we're watching videos on these.
Yeah.
And then you come out thinking, oh, these are brilliant. Yeah. And I know something can, no. you know, can yeah, go into your head and you think, well, you've still got to do that. But you should always finish a meeting with obviously your positives and your plus points. Because if you come out of a meeting and you've just done nothing but talk about how good the opposition are. And look, we can all put clips together of how good anyone is. We've seen all the players over the years, haven't we? Yeah. So if you put clips together of certain teams and how good they are, you'll come out maybe beating them a little bit.
To try and meet Johnny King, God rest his soul, great fella, Johnny. I love playing for him. But every time we played a team, he'd have a meeting and he'd have a clipboard telling you all about how good they were. And I'm thinking, fuck me. Who's pushed the toilet? About 2 hours before the game. When Robbie's right, you've got to be aware of what they can do, but not drilled.
Yeah.
Because psychologically in football, that has a big burden on how you approach a match, how you get into the match, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you should be analysing yourself as well and telling you how good you are as well. Anyway, that was the first part of the show. Aldo meets with the great Roberto Fowler.
Falero. Maybe we call myself Roberto Falero.
Roberto Falero. And we'll be back with part two shortly. Welcome back to part two of Aldo Meets with Peter Shriver's Wham. Is that right, Shriver's Man?
Yeah, it sounds a bit
close enough, wasn't it?
Close enough to say Peter.
I've just got there now. 13 episodes.
Peter Shriver's Man, James Pearce and Robbie Fowler. Right, Rob, let's go back to the beginning, mate. I've grown up as a kid in the South End. We're good South Enders, you know, me and Robbie. A couple of miles apart, with Callie and Jimmy Case come from there, but Sammy lives it. And Toxteth or Dingle. My family came from the Dingle, the old disease. Yep. You just come from the road, didn't you?
Yeah, just up the road, yeah. And it's funny actually, because when you think of certainly Liverpool lads, I mean Toxteth is literally a mile from the city centre. So yeah. I reckon I'm probably one of the players, not only me obviously, but one of the only players who probably closest to Liverpool, Liverpool city centre.
Sammy was up that
so
way.
Sammy was a bully, wasn't he? So Sammy would he'd be pretty close. But with Sammy's legs, I mean, it probably took him longer. but yeah, obviously, Callie was the
Callie's from Toxteth.
What an absolute superstar! We all love Callie.
I love him, love him to death. Yeah, but it was also called that possibly with the heartbeat of Liverpool. Dingle and Toxteth over the years. That was the heart of Liverpool. That did you know that, don't you?
No, I didn't, but I do now.
My dad told me that. It might have been in Paris, but but it was the heartbeat of Liverpool.
But it's funny actually, because I think you are maybe like you're a product of where you're from, aren't you? So I think that's probably why, I mean, the likes of all those Sammy, you know, Cali and even myself, you know, Maka being from obviously the area where he was from as well. You sort of have a little bit of, I don't know, it's something inside you that sort of drives you to go on and become players. And
edge.
I think it's the simple fact that where we're from sort of makes you become this player. And obviously there's more to it than that, but your upbringing definitely, and it's where you're from. You are a product of the environment, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't have it easy, did we? This city, you know, the 50, 60, 70, but even that's a fight against all everything in the adversity over the years. But yeah, I think it makes you stronger, you know, and sometimes you get a bit of luck, you know, different ways. I went a different way to Robbie. Robbie got the luck he deserved because everyone knew when he was young how good he was. You know, even I was in, you know, from a distance away when he was like 14, this young lad prodigy, you know, it's going to be something else. And then most of them, unfortunately, fall away. But what Robbie said, he had the will to plow on and keep on going and going, get the breaks, but as soon as you get the break, it doesn't mean that you're going to make it. Then it's up to you, isn't it? You know, that's when things does get something. You've got to grasp it and make it work.
I mean, I think you're spot on. I think before I left school, I knew I was going to be a professional. Now, to what level I was going to get to, it was entirely up to me. I had like a one-year YTS, which obviously the equivalent of an apprenticeship, and then I signed a three-year professional. Then it was up to me, but I totally agree with Aldo there. I think you obviously need to have that talent, you need to have that dedication, that sacrifice, but luck plays a huge part.
You've got to have a certain amount. But like when I was growing up, my dad was really clever in various ways. He wasn't a footballer himself, although he told me he was. He wasn't a footballer himself. But like your dad as well was a big inspiration to you and Rob.
I think when you sort of look at your career, I think there's always maybe that one person who would probably you'd put above it other people.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I think my mum was massively instrumental in helping me become a footballer because, you know, my mum and dad never lived together, you know, split up probably before I was born. And, you know, my mum was the one who gave me all the money to go and, you know, travel to these games. But I was close to my dad, always close to my dad. But my dad was like, you know, if you want to be a footballer, this is what you got to do. Yeah. And I'd be on the local field, you know, practicing with my left and my right foot, heading. My dad was probably my first coach. Now, you know, it's obviously when you get older, you're obviously with teams and you have other coaches, but my dad was always made that coach who drove you on and drive you on to be sort of better every single day. Don't get me wrong, I think you've got to have something within you to want to go and do that as well, because, you know, let's be honest, you know, if you don't want to do it, you don't do it, do you?
Mm-hmm.
But as much as, you know, I want to do it, I think you still need someone to sort of give you a little bit of drive.
Oh, yeah. So, obviously, you was never told, you probably that your dad, from your dad, he's pretty funny, your dad, don't you know what I mean? But did you used to go to the Everton games?
Yeah, I mean, sort of mid to late 80s. I mean, I was at a game all the time.
And who was your favourite players?
My favourite players were Trevor Stephen and Graeme Sharp. I mean, I've seen a bit of myself in them. Trevor Stephen, because he was like tricky, and Graeme Sharp because he scored goals, and I love goal scorers. That's not to say I wasn't like a bitter blue who like hated Liverpool. I mean, I was quite lucky in the 80s with growing up, and Everton Liverpool were by far the best teams anyway. So I sort of always appreciated Liverpool, and I always obviously appreciated yourself and Rushy for the goals that you scored. I mean, I know you were obviously late 80s and you know, but Rushy, you know, scoring goals as well. I was always massively in awe of the goals that he scored as well. I'd go to game with obviously my uncles, my dad was a blue, but you know, all my dad was like the black sheep of the family. I'm not sure what can you say that anymore. I think you can't you? I don't know. Apologies if people get offended, but my dad's family were all red.
Yeah.
All reds. My dad was a blue, so he was like, he went against the grain. But all my mum's side of family are all blues and still all blues. So I went a few years without speaking to them. or they went a few years without speaking to me.
But you're right, because in the 70s and 80s, it was a friendly rivalry. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, the younger people are just more than bitter now, obviously, being older. But yeah, did you used to go to away games as well?
No. I went to like cup games, obviously semi-finals and finals, but never really away games. I go to Goodison whenever I could, really.
But when you signed for Liverpool, did you still go to Goodison?
When I was signed as a professional, when I was younger, I mean, look, you've got to remember I was at Liverpool for when I was 11. So then I was gradually changing as well. Then so. How I signed for Liverpool was a scout called Jim Aspinall, who sadly no longer with us. He was instrumental in getting me to go to Liverpool. I knew I was an Everton fan, and Jim's oppo, if you like, was a fellow called Sid Benson, who was the Everton scout, who's again, he's sadly no longer with us. Lovely fellas, both of them. But Jim was the first one who came up to me, and I'd like to think I've always had a little bit of loyalty. And because Jim was the first one, I went, you know what, I'm going to go there. And people might have thought, well, you know, you're never a supporter, so why don't you go to them? And I went to Liverpool from when I was 11. You get to 14 and then you become an age where you've got to sign schoolboy forms. And Everton were desperate to get me. But I was happy at Liverpool. I was comfortable at Liverpool. You know, Steve Ivey, Hugh McCauley, Dave Shannon were probably the only coaches that we had. So before Steve, there was a fella called Mal Cook, and obviously Steve, I mean, I don't know how they did it, to be fair. I mean, they mustn't have had families themselves, because every time there was anything football related, they were at, you know, was Melwood, or we trained at the Fern and Sankstead as well. You know, so I mean, they were instrumental in sort of me staying at Liverpool as well, because they were so good, and they were so like, I mean, friendly in terms of trying to get the best out of you. I mean, I never really wanted to go anywhere else. So once Everton were trying to obviously sign me again, I was at Liverpool, so I was going nowhere. Mm-hmm. I genuinely started liking Liverpool from when I was maybe 10, 11. But I would go to the Everton games, probably up till about 14, 15. And then, you know, well, I've proven to make the right choice, haven't I?
Good decision. Yeah,
I mean, look, you know,
good decision.
I mean,
and then
I think of my lad now. So my lad's 18 now. He's been to FA Cup finals, League Cup finals, European Cup finals, you know, UEFA Cup finals. I mean, you've seen, you know, us win the Premier League.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was an Everton fan, you know, and I had a lad, you know, I mean, he'd be...
It's true though, isn't it?
First round Carabao Cup at a push. Second.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he'd be too happy with me. So, I genuinely know I've made the right choice anyway.
You mentioned that game against Fulham, your debut September 1993. You score in that first leg against Fulham, and you then get five in the second leg.
Yeah.
Anfield, like, Was there any sense of nerves at all? Did you just instantly feel like you just belonged to that level?
Yeah, no, I did. I genuinely never played a lot of reserve games, you know. So I was maybe playing B team and the A team. I probably had, someone might prove me wrong here, but I didn't even have a full season playing the reserves. I reckon I played probably about 10, 15 games only for the reserves. And you know what, I just felt comfortable, I felt confident, and I think that's the, you know, without being big-headed, I was always confident, and I was always probably a little bit of a cheeky chap, which probably helps with the confidence as well.
You've got so much in common with me, you know.
I look, that's the way football is. I think if you're confident, I think you obviously need a little bit of talent as well. Yeah. But if you've got that talent with the confidence, then you can go on. So you just mentioned Fulham. I'd been in and around the first team for a long time before I made my debut. I mean, not too many people know. The first year of the Premier League, the last game of the season, we played Tottenham. I was sub in the last game of the season. We won 6-2. And this sounds ridiculous, but it was a close 6-2. only for the fact is that it was 3-2 with like 5 minutes to go. And right. it was like, I think it was only two subs. I think it was myself and Torben Picknick. Were subs, and Graham Souness never put me on, and I'm glad he never put me on because I probably wasn't ready. I mean, I was the size that I was tiny, you know, I was really thin, made up for it since, obviously. I made my debut. I travelled obviously with a team, a lot of league games, made my debut in the cup away, and done really, really well. So I know you've mentioned the score, but I also had an hand in the other two goals, kept my place for the game. Kept my place for the game against Chelsea on the Saturday. We lost 1-0, but one of the games which, you know, you've mentioned was the second leg. Obviously 5-0 win, scoring five goals. I mean, for a young kid to do that, and it probably really never resonated or stuck with me until I'd finished my career, and I think that was my first game as a professional at Anfield. Yeah. My first game, you know, at Anfield as a professional for Liverpool. Scoring five goals as an 18-year-old. I mean, it's
ridiculous.
I will pat myself in the back, because to do that as an 18-year-old in a first class game, I think it's phenomenal.
So it's not the mentality to do it as well. The ability, yeah, but it's not the mentality to go out and do it.
Yeah,
and as you say, great Graham soon has seen that. You've got to give him credit for seeing and managing and nurturing Robbie in the right manner to get him off and running. You're right, getting the right time to put you in, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. But can we go back to scoring five? it's phenomenal when you sort of think back, and you know, imagine nowadays with like social media and, you know, obviously the way the world is now, the modern world. Imagine an 18-year-old kid coming on and scoring five goals, you know, at Anfield.
No, you're right, no, it's spot on. Yeah. I mean,
wow.
And then, of course, We've just gone past the 30th anniversary of your hat trick against Arsenal.
It's still the best one though. It is that one.
Is that
the best?
6 minutes was it?
Four minutes, 33 seconds.
Oh, that was mine. 6 minutes against Ipswich.
And as you said, it stood for 20 odd years until Sadio Mane had the cheat to beat it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I love Sadio.
For Southampton.
He done it in like two minutes 55, didn't he? So, I mean, he absolutely didn't defeat it. I still think mine was better. I mean, I'm not even messing here, by the way. I'm genuinely serious. I mean, I love Sadio. I think the player he was for Liverpool, phenomenal player. I love him to bits. And I actually said to him mine was better, because mine was against an Arsenal side that consisted of five England internationals, obviously four defenders and the goalkeeper, whereas was against a very, very poor, at the time, Aston Villa. Yeah. So I think the game...
It's still your record, really.
Might as well. I think they won the game 8-8 something, or 7-1, or you know, something stupid, whereas mine was against...
I can't even remember Sadio.
There you go.
I can't remember.
I missed my case.
I actually, my quickest one was, we were getting beat 3-0 by Ipswich at Oxford. And I scored a hat-trick in 6 minutes, I think it was 6 minutes.
That was my quickest, but it's only Ipswich, it wasn't Arsenal.
Yeah. and then of course you win your first major trophy when Liverpool beat Bolton in the League Cup final at Wembley, and obviously Steve McManaman, your good mate, was sensational that day, didn't he? When he scored both goals, was it special sharing that journey with him? Because obviously both of you, you know, had come from the youth section, and suddenly your lives are suddenly changed.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Macca's a little bit older than me. I think we've obviously mentioned how Macca was. I first met Macca when we were playing for Liverpool Schoolboys. I think he was playing for the under 14s, and I was playing for the under 11s. And we went to Holland as a group of schoolboy teams, so under 11s, under 14s. I think we first met each other then. But when you talk about players coming through systems, and you know, someone who you look up to, I suppose I always looked up to Macca because I always seen how good he was, and he, you know, all I've mentioned before about, you know, people were talking about me scoring goals and being this player, but Macca was someone I knew about before he knew me because of the brilliance that he was. You know, his record at youth football was brilliant, and obviously getting into the team, obviously being both local lads, and you know, he sort of took me under his wing, I mean, to this day, I mean, I love Macca, genuinely do. I think he's a great lad. He's helped me in so many ways in terms of, you know, growing and developing as a player. I'm not ashamed to admit this. I think he, you know, when you talk about the great players that, you know, we've all played under, you know, and you know, you mentioned the likes of Ken Dalglish, Stevie G, you know,
Barnes,
probably Barnes, you know, all the greatest players are, you know, who you could have an argument for saying who's the best player to played with. And I always put Macca as mine. Now, you know, I'm not saying he was better than Kenny, or I'm not saying he was better than Stephen, but he was the best for me. Yeah. So every player will have sort of their own individual reason why this player's. I mean, Rushy would say, you know, Kenny was his best player because of the amount of goals he scored, but I mean, Macca was my favourite player playing for Liverpool. He was brilliant.
He was sensational. I do think he's underappreciated in general in terms of when people talk about the greats.
Yeah.
But maybe that's because as a team, you didn't win as much as you probably could and should have done. And also, obviously, because he goes to Real Madrid, and at the time, the Bosman thing was new, wasn't it?
Yeah, but don't forget, no one knows about that. I'm sure. I think Macca's going to come on a podcast and learn that the club was.
They tried to sell him the year before, weren't they?
The club was to blame for that, you know, and we'll put that out when he comes here. He can put it across because a lot of people held a grudge against him, didn't they?
And I'm thinking, unfairly, yeah.
They don't know the true story, you know, about Steve. Yeah. I agree with Robbie, technically, what a fantastic player, you know, and he went on to great things as well.
But you know what they say about him as well? You might get obviously being a local lad, you know, playing for Liverpool and being a player that we all knew he was brilliant. But to go over and play for Real Madrid, who were classed as the Galacticos then, and not look out of place, tells you everything you need to know about Macca. A phenomenal player.
And you won back-to-back PFA Young Player of the Year awards. That things like that must mean a lot when you're getting voted for by your peers.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't think of it. It's brilliant, but I'm probably more disappointed than ever won it the third time.
Right.
Because, I mean, you think and you're proud, and quite rightly so, of you know, of your achievements and, you know, and what you did to sort of to get these awards. But I think the third year, I think I'd scored, I mean, 20 or 30 goals again, so probably should have had it then. So, I mean, that probably would have been a better hat-trick for me as well. So as much as you sit here and quite rightly proud and, you know, very humble about, you know, getting picked by your peers as one of the young players, I'm probably disappointed that I never won it the third time because I probably should have done, in all honesty.
We were going to talk about the FA Cup final, but I don't want to talk about that. No, don't. It's no, the spice balls and all that bollocks.
Have you still got your white suit?
Exactly. You know what? I have. Well, I mean, I'm saying I've got it, right? And it's actually in the Football Museum in Manchester.
Is it?
I should get it back and put it in the Club Museum, really, so people can start throwing tomorrow. When I think of football, look, I grew up on the FA Cup. That was the first trophy I ever wanted to win, was the FA Cup. You're obviously a little bit older than me, although, so you might tell me. I think it was maybe 79. Was it Stoke or Sunderland got to the final?
Sunderland.
I think Stoke might have done it as well a year or two before. And
Stoke was the manager, wasn't it?
Not Stoke. No, you're Stoke. Yeah, Stoke was. Yeah, sorry, I tell a lie. But A team had white suits on.
Southampton, but
I don't know. I think if someone wants to, you know, look into that, someone definitely wore cream suits.
Did they win it?
I think they won it.
But if you win that final, nobody ever talks about the suits.
Look, I won't talk about it. They still celebrate it.
Yeah, but I mean, we go back to the suits. And, I mean,
just blame James here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the probably sad thing about it was, I mean, you know, getting to an FA Cup final, everything's about, we used to get like the suits for nothing, yeah. Right? And I was like, go and wear these suits. Yeah. You're going to parade them on Cup final day. I think we were the first club in the history of the FA Cup to actually pay for our own suits. We actually bought them as well.
Armani.
We paid for them ourselves. I mean, wow. So that's where
it was.
So that's what it was. So, I mean, a lot of people just got rid of theirs and I kept mine. For some reason, I tried it on years later, and it fitted me so much. It must have been swimming on me when I wore it. I mean, you can imagine sort of the mid-90s, everything was massive. Anyway, you look at all the kids.
Baggy stuff on it, yeah.
I must have been walking down Wembley Way dressed like MC Hammer. You know, honestly, it must have been huge. And obviously, the football museum has got in touch and said, can we borrow it? And it's still in the football museum now.
Andy, you go from that to when you got fined by UEFA for the T-shirt showing the support for the Dockers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, that was that was Macca, and Macca's uncle was about to lose his job down the docks, and Macca just come up to me before a pre-match meal it was, and say, you know, put these shirts on tonight, and you know, we were always going to win the game. And after we win the game, we'll take the shirts off, and you know, when you're doing a lap of honour after the match, yeah, we'll show people, and we'll get the plight out there that way. And me being me just got carried away and scored a goal and just lifted her up. And I think the advert, if you like, or the advertisement, and you know, the amount of people that went out to it, I mean, it just sort of raised real awareness to people who were having a tough time and about to lose their jobs. And it was down to Macca again, because he wanted to sort of get out there. Macca's uncle was a dog. So, absolutely, you know, it was for me a genuinely great course.
What did he find you?
I think I got fined probably about maybe about €10,000, or I don't even know it was euros at the time. You know, that's a pay. Yeah, I can't even remember.
I have to say, well worth it.
Yeah.
You know, such statement, you just show, again, we talked earlier about where you are from and the people that you respect, and that sense of, actually, we talked about it before we came on the podcast as well, what makes Scouser special, sticking together, support. Yeah. You got that platform, you score that goal to show that. I think it's well worth the penalty.
That was it. I mean, you just mentioned platform. I couldn't think of that word before, but that was what it was. So give this platform to sort of highlight this course. And I mean, even now, I mean, how long ago was it? It was, you know, 20, 30 years, yeah, 30 longer years. And people still come up to me now talking about we have the castle in town now, which is obviously the Dockers bar, if you like. And you go in,
good
there
bar,
and,
hasn't it?
I don't know, I've never been in it. Well,
that's taking it there, isn't it?
I mean, that is still going strong, and it's thanks to the donations that people still give for this course.
And Robbie, how many players that are as driven and competitive as you debate with the referee about if it was a penalty or not, which is what you got a UEFA Fair Play Award for? I mean, that says a lot about you as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's funny now, because if you take that challenge now and put it in the modern game, I think it's probably a penalty.
Okay.
Now, and it's probably because
he's got in your way.
Yeah, and I've jumped over the keeper and lost my balance, and at the time I didn't think it was a penalty. Excuse me, I didn't think it was a penalty. But if I think back now, you know, if I'd have just ran straight, I mean, I'd have hurt myself or hurt him. Now, if I'd have just ran into him, I mean,
Well, that's what they do. I got sent
off myself. Mm-hmm. So I just felt, you know, I want to score. And you'll know this, if I'm going around a keeper, if the keeper touches me, I want to stay on my feet. I want to try and score, because I love scoring goals.
Yeah.
Now, the game has maybe changed a little bit now, whereas if he touches you, everyone's going straight down.
Yeah.
Whether it's a penalty or not, you know, that's another
debate. One Anthony Gordon, one that was very, very similar to what you did, didn't it? Similar.
was it?
I think he could have stayed on his feet. But in our day, and you're right, you don't see many players doing that. We used to go, when the goalie comes out, he's out of position, you go around him, it's goal. You take it too wide, it's going to be out. But they don't do it now. Would you say they play for the penalties?
I just wanted to score. And at the time, going back to that, I didn't think it was a penalty. And I just thought, you know, England international, an England teammate, David Seaver, I probably didn't want him to get sent off. So I think that was maybe what I was doing that for as well. Not a penalty, but it was also the fact is don't send them off type of thing, you know what I mean? That's so and obviously David Seaver is a lot bigger than me, so he didn't get anybody.
And then you had that strange period where Houllier and Evans were joint managers. That must have been strange from a player's perspective when you didn't really know exactly who was in charge.
Yeah, and look, I think if we sort of look back now, and a club the size of Liverpool should never have been in that position where you've got joint managers. And I sort of felt for Roy Evans probably more than anyone, because you know, if you take what Roy done, and you know, he was probably when you think of Liverpool and the history of what they've won, what they've achieved, Roy Evans, because he never won what the ex-managers have won and the ex-coaches, he was sort of laughed at is the wrong word. I can't think what word. I mean, I just think he probably didn't get the accolades you know, he could have done, because, I mean, we finished second, third, second. And for a club who were relatively struggling and trying to get back to where you know where the club once was. I mean, it's probably a great record.
Yeah.
Now you look at the modern football now, and you think of managers who finish in second, third. I mean, they're all like lauded and all, you know, brilliant, what a job. Mm. But the job Roy Evans done, we thought was brilliant, but it was maybe maybe guilty or of maybe Liverpool's.
That's it.
Honours of the past.
That's
you
exactly
mean,
what.
That's sort of what sort
that's
of.
That's exactly. The expectations were so high. And there were some really good teams knocking about in that era. You know, Liverpool, we'd lost our way. But we'd been caught up, wouldn't we?
I mean, look, people can decide. We always thought we were a good side and probably could have been a little bit better in terms of what we won. But it was certainly not through the lack of effort from, certainly from Roy's tenor. I mean, Roy was brilliant. I've got a lot of time for
brilliant. Yeah. Well, just looking at the players you played alongside, Rob, Colly Moore, you know, Michael Rushy, Emileski as well. Yeah, who was your favourite one?
I mean, I learned so much from every player, if I'm being honest. And I think this is what you talked before about being a manager. You know, you probably take something from every manager you played under. And I'd like to think I was clever enough to sort of learn from every player.
You've got a football brain. I mean, as a forward, you know, as a centre forward, like, I played holding line a lot in my career, but then I really enjoyed playing off of, like, Billy Hamilton and Rockers, the big tulls, playing off him, like you did with them in many, many ways. It's just the way your favourites is, or when you're winning things. And I'm looking, who was the best for you then, rather than saying your favourite, who was the best for you to play alongside, I mean, to get your goals?
Again, I mean, look, this is not an easy...
Top players.
I mean, I will say this is easy for me to say. It's not easy in terms of the players I play, because I play with great players. I mean, Michael was a great player. Emil was brilliant in terms of what he brought to the game. I mean, I've mentioned Macca. Rushy was phenomenal. He really was. I know I'm saying this in front of you, but he probably is Liverpool's greatest goal scorer. We know that, you know, we're not stupid enough to admit that or not admit that. But for me, the best player I played with, my best partner, was Stan Collymore. Mm. Now, he wasn't the best player I played with, but although just mentioned, his best partner was someone who he scored goals with. Again, Rushy's was Kenny. And I probably think of my most prolific time, I was partnered by Stan. Now, it was... I mean, very fruitful in terms of the goals and the goals that we scored as a partnership, the goals I scored as an individual. But I'd like to think we sort of complement each other very well as well, because, you know, as much as I score goals, I'd like to think I had more in the locker. you know, I could drop, you know, I was not bad in the air, you know, I could bring other players into the game. And obviously with Stan, I knew sort of Stan could do that as well. So I sort of knew what he could do and I knew what I could do better and sort of let Stan do what he needed to do to sort of try and make me score goals. So we sort of worked really, really well in tandem.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Well, that's the end of part two, which went very, very quickly. We'll see you in part three.
Robbie, let's talk about the treble winning season of 2001. You know, it started off the first of the three, the League Cup final against Birmingham City. You must have great memories of that day. Must be up there with one of the best goals you scored that opener. And then you're obviously captain as well. You hold your nerve in the shootout. Talk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, really, really fond memories of obviously that year. And I think obviously that particular game, you know, that was maybe the catalyst of us growing and knowing that we could compete. Okay, Birmingham were, you know, a championship club at the time. But it was a tough game. I remember being tough, and I think it was comfortable in terms of, you know, we were into this, I think it was pretty early when the goal, this early, and then it was, shit, it's a tough game, this, and he made it really hard, and obviously just the all equaliser. Late in the game, you know, arguments that he probably could have had a penalty as well, another penalty. But it goes to penalties and we end up winning the game. But I think that was a real catalyst for the season, you know, going on to achieve what we did. I mean, by professional footballing standards, you know, to play every single or every conceivable game that year that we could have done was a massive achievement. You know, I didn't start as many games as what I would have liked. I want to start every game. You know, I was greedy and, you know, I would never sort of apologise for that. I wanted to play every single game. You know, that's the way I was. You know, I didn't want to sit on my arse and collect wages. I wanted to be the hero. I wanted to score goals. I wanted to be the main man. Mm. You know, again, it's not an egotistical, you know.
No, but that's what strikers. What strikers want. If you haven't got them traits, then you shouldn't be a striker.
Yeah.
No, that's the way it works, Robin.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So, you know, and we'll talk about other finals as well. But you know, I more than played my part in that year. You know, scored in two finals. You know, we'll talk. But I'm sure you'll go to questions. But I don't really want to. Talk now.
Deliver's final.
Yeah, that was a crazy game, wasn't it?
The Alibers final. Yeah. They all ended up, didn't they, that season? That all went to penalties.
You had obviously Michael Owen's late
double against
Arsenal.
Michael Owen won.
The Alibers won, no doubt, the golden, I think it might have been a silver goal or a golden goal winner. So we scored, I mean, they had two men sent off. So I think we were always going to win that game. Yeah. Because they were just like sort of defending. I mean, they were definitely playing for penalties. But obviously it was the own goal. That's probably one of the things I'm probably disappointed about, you know, in my career as well. We spoke before about you wanting to be, you probably want to be the factor, whereas you wanted to change something. You want to be talked about in the history of the club, right? So the Birmingham Cup final, right? Winning 1-0, equalised. So that's me chalked off for being the hero for that one.
Yeah.
The Alibers one, you know, scored, they equalised in the last minute. So that's another probably moment of hero-ness taken away from me.
This is how forwards think, you know, strikers in spot.
I love it.
I mean, I even think back to, you know, penalty. I mean, England, Euro 96, I was down to take the fifth penalty against Spain. I would have been the hero there. Champions League semi-final, I was down to take the fifth penalty.
Then it's against Chelsea.
Against Chelsea, yeah. I want to be the hero for that one as well. So I think it's probably just typical of my Liverpool thing, just always being that little bit part player.
And then, of course, within like 7 or 8 months of the treble, you end up moving on to Leeds. Like, was that a difficult period? Because you've been associated with the club for so long.
I mean, it was a horrendous period, in all honesty, because, you know, again, no disrespect to Leeds, but I never really wanted to lead the club. Mm. I mean, it was my decision to leave in the end, but I felt as I was forced to leave because I knew I was sort of pissing into the wind. You know, I knew what was happening. The club had tried to sell me a few times. I mean, Aston Villa tried to buy me. I think the club had accepted.
Was that Ron Atkinson then?
I don't know. I think it might have been Brian Little, I think. I don't know. Chelsea tried to sign me. I was sat at my mate's house one night and I get a phone call from Gianluca Vialli, and he said, obviously, the club have agreed a fee, and when can you come down and speak to us? And I went to him, I said, I have to speak to the club. I said, I didn't know what was for sale. He went, yeah, we've got an affidavit from the club. So that was, I knew the club were trying to sell me. So then, you know, it probably kills you to sort of admit that, because you always want to be, if I had a choice, I'd have been a Liverpool player for life.
But there's things
that happen behind the scenes where you know you're not going to be part of the plans, and I just knew that, so probably needed to go for my own sanity, if you like. Yeah. And Leeds came in and I went, you know what, I think I'm best going just for my own sanity, and in a way, big club Leeds. Yeah, man. I mean, Leeds was brilliant, genuinely was. And in a way, so I'm glad I left though, because I got to appreciate Liverpool a bit more. And it sounds stupid because, I mean, I've been at Liverpool from when I was 11, go through B teams, A teams, reserve teams, first teams. And then, you know, I never knew what anything else was like. So when you go and play, and Leeds was a big club. Leeds was genuinely a big club, but not as big as Liverpool.
No.
Obviously, then I went to Man City. Man City is obviously not the Man City we see today, but I enjoyed my time at Man City. Not at first, admittedly, because I took my time to sort of get going. Probably because I didn't really want to leave Leeds, if I'm being honest. But Leeds was, I mean, it was probably a bit of, at the time, a bit of a basket case of a club, whereas, they were falling apart, weren't they?
Yeah.
And I was obviously one of the big wage earners, and you know, the club needed me gone, so I went to City. So again, I felt as I was forced to leave, leave Leeds to go to Man City. Didn't enjoy it there at the start, but got to really enjoy it. And there was great people at that club, there really was. And I ended up going back to Liverpool. And that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because, you know, we speak about winning trophies, scoring goals, playing everything, doing everything for Liverpool is the be all and end all for me. But getting the chance to re-sign for Liverpool, I mean, that was my best football moment.
So you never envisioned that would happen.
No.
You think it's all over. Yeah,
absolutely. You think, don't you, you'll never get a chance you never get a chance again. But I'm glad I did, because I got to appreciate Liverpool a bit more.
Yeah.
And I got, obviously I've got four kids, and my three daughters had all seen me play for Liverpool.
Yeah.
And then obviously my lad, who was born in 2006, he won't remember. But he got to see me in a Liverpool shirt as well. So that's one thing I'm proud of as well. That all my family have seen me represent Liverpool, which is brilliant.
Yeah. And playing for Rafa Benitez, how did that compare to, say, Houllier or Evans or Souness that you played for previously?
I mean, Rafa was, again, I mentioned before with Rafa, technically, tactically, brilliant. I remember once Sammy Lee, he gave us like a DVD, and he said, we dropped this off at Rafa's, because Rafa lived near me. And it was around Christmas time, and I've dropped it into Rafa's house, and, you know, I think Rafa's family were back in Spain.
Did you watch it beforehand?
So anyway, I've got this DVD, and I go to Rafa's house, and obviously his family are back in Spain. And Rafa invited me in, and I goes into his living room, and he's got this big television on there. He's got a television here and a television there. He's got like two computers in front of him, and all of them have different games on. And he's just like so intense with football. And I think, wow, you know what I mean? Is this what it takes to be like a great manager? Yeah. So, I mean, look, I've got so much time for Rafa. Yeah. I think he can be a bit cold. He can be a little bit heartless at times. But Rafa's, I think his remit is, you know, I'm not here to be like that. I'm here to do a job. And I think that's probably what, you know, Rafa took into his role as a manager sort of everywhere he's been. Technically, he was brilliant. But a little bit cold, but I don't like saying any bad about him, because he brought me back. And I sort of knew, I knew my place this time at Liverpool. You know, I genuinely knew what was happening. You know, I knew I wasn't going to play games, but I'd like to think my goals for games was probably better in the second spell than the first one. That sounds a bit stupid. But, you know,
I'm glad you're going on about that because you scored 183 goals in 369 games for Liverpool, which is very good. Makes you the seventh highest goal scorer in the club's history. You surpassed the 30 goal mark in three successive seasons. Midnight, that's brilliant.
That's when I should have won the PFA three times.
You had to pick one of them goals. Which would be your favourite? And that's hard. I know that's really tough.
I mean, it's incredibly hard, to be fair. But, you know, it's... look, I suppose being a Liverpool player, right, I think any goal against Everton or Man United is always probably up there, and you probably rank them. But you've mentioned the treble season, and I always think of the last game of the season against Charlton. Yeah, and I always think that is probably my best one. Yeah. Not because it was an unbelievable goal, but I think it was what it meant.
The lob, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was an overhead kick, but it wasn't like a Pelé overhead kick. It was like a measured overhead kick. But I don't think it was like brilliant in terms of like an individual goal, but I think it was brilliant in terms of what it was for the club.
Yeah.
You know, we won all the trophies. You know, we won the League Cup, the UEFA Cup and the FA Cup, but the club hadn't been in the Champions League for a number of years, and we needed to win this last game of the season. And I mean, I remember the first half against Charlton, I think we were dire. Now, I think it was because we'd had obviously the week before the FA Cup final, midweek was the UEFA Cup. And then obviously the last game. I think it was a Sunday.
I was in Dublin. We watched that in Dublin.
I might be wrong anyway. So that was the last game of the season. We needed to win that.
Yeah, it would have been a Sunday, right?
Yeah. And I think first half we were dire, genuinely. And then second half we sort of started a little bit better. And this goal was like the catalyst of ended up like winning this game 4-0. But that goal was probably my favourite one because of what it meant for the club, getting us back where I think we belonged.
Robbie,
some of our listeners, they don't have anywhere near the insight that you have in terms of, you mentioned earlier, you went from Liverpool to Leeds to City. Granted, City wasn't the City that it is today, but Leeds was a big club. But what and you said yourself, you didn't know anything else but Liverpool, and then you went to Leeds. What would you say to listeners that don't have, and viewers that don't have the insight, like, what is the difference during that era between Liverpool and Leeds, apart from trophies won and stuff? But like day-to-day, logistics, maybe the training ground, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of everything, to be honest. And, you know, I would never be disrespectful to any club that I've played for in the past. And, you know, that's just not what I'm about. Well, Leeds was a big club, but we know the history, we know the tradition of Liverpool, and we all know and we all think it's bigger. And I know it's bigger because I've been to other clubs, and although I'll tell you, he's been to other clubs, and you probably appreciate Liverpool a bit more because you've been to other clubs and you know what they're like. So, I mean, it might be the infrastructure, it might be the grounds, it might be the state, it might be the training ground, it might be people within the system set up, the hierarchy, if you like, of the CEOs. But Liverpool always felt bigger. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't really know the definitive answer, but it's just something that we sort of ourselves pride ourselves on. You know, we always want to play for big clubs. You know, we always want to do that. We always want to be successful at the biggest club. And I always thought Liverpool were a massive club. And it's probably because of the upbringing, certainly in the 80s. I mean, I know Liverpool won stuff in decades before that. But certainly in my era, growing up watching football, Liverpool were instrumental in winning trophies. Liverpool were always classed as a big club. And they are a big club. But my take on that is I never knew anywhere else. Mm-hmm. I'd only ever been at Liverpool. So don't take this the wrong way by any means, but I maybe took it for granted. Mm-hmm. I genuinely might have taken it a little bit for granted because I didn't know anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And you probably appreciate it more when you go and see other places. And I hope that doesn't come across as crass. And there's far bigger supporters than me out there. But I mean, you've got to remember, don't get me wrong, I loved it. But, you know, I'm there to try and do a job. And I tried to do that job the very best I could. I always wanted to be successful. But I didn't know anywhere else. Didn't know anything different.
Got a couple of ones to finish on, Rob. Who's the toughest defender that you think you faced?
You know, I get asked this quite a lot, to be honest, and I don't really know the answer. Mm. Only for the simple fact, as I mentioned before, about, you know, how confident I was, and I'm always one of them. I'll go into the game, and I wasn't fazed by playing against anyone. I think if you go into a game, and you'll notice, although, if you go into a game and you're worried about coming up against a centre-half, then I think that has an adverse effect on your game. I never, don't get me wrong, I played against great players. I mean, I mentioned before, the Arsenal back four, you know, great Man United parents of Steve Bruce, you know,
Greg Pallister. Paul McGrath.
Yeah, I would have done, but probably when he was coming towards the end of his career. The likes of Tony Adams, Steve Ball, Tony Adams, Martin Keown, all great players. So I always give parents a nod as opposed to individuals, because if you're up against an individual and you sort of fear them, or I would never say individuals, but parents or maybe teams in certain stadiums. Again, I just wasn't fazed by playing against anyone. In fact, when you played against bigger teams or in big stadiums, I loved her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to do better, so I wasn't worried about anyone who would come up against. I mean, you can answer this as well. We probably played against some of the great centre-halves in training every single day for the teams that we played for.
Yeah.
So, I always mention that as well.
Yeah, you don't do that. Yeah, like Alan Hansen, obviously. And just there to finish on, you know, you've done a hell of a lot in your career, wherever you've been, wherever you've gone, international scene or that. What are you most proud of?
I mean, I don't know. Give us more of a definitive question.
Was it the first time you pulled on a Liverpool shirt? Was it when you scored the five against Fulham, or when you won the cups that you won? A certain moment.
What means the most to you?
That you know, yeah.
I mean, look, away from football, it's obviously your family. And I know that's maybe a cliche answer, but that will always be the number one.
The older you get, you realise that, yeah.
And I don't think anyone would hold it against me. From a playing point of view, I've just mentioned before about going back to Liverpool. My last game of the season, my last game of me being a Liverpool shirt, doing a lap of honour. I mean, that was brilliant for all the wrong reasons. Because I think if the club had said to me, I mean, I was only probably 31, so you'd like to think I had a few more years left of me. But you know, if the club had said to me, just stay and, you know, coach the kids or go, we want you to be a reserve manager, I'd have done that. Mm. I'd have packed everything else in and just done, I'd do that, because that was what Liverpool was. So I was always a little bit peeved off with that, to be fair. I never sort of got the chance. I know Alex Inglethorpe now is brilliant with obviously myself and a lot of the other ex players coming to the academy. But I would have loved at the time for someone to say that coming, because we were built on the boot room tradition.
Yeah.
So I may be a little bit peeved off. I wasn't maybe asked to come in, through that system that way. So I had to go away and do my own things. I know I've gone off topic there, but I think what I'm proud of is the fact is that when I done that lap of honour with all my family, walking around with my little boy in my arms, that's probably my proudest moment as a Liverpool fan, because I got to appreciate what the Liverpool fans appreciated, and I loved that. I mean, I go back to obviously my second time when I signed Liverpool, being sudden coming on. I mean, the noise and the rapturous applause I got, it was brilliant. But in a sad sort of way, my last game doing that lap of honour was incredible. It really was. And I mean, it wasn't the bit where we see now where you get like...
But
we see now all the players go who were here for 2 minutes and you get like... a big shirt. I was just walking around. Thanks for coming.
Well, we've got to end on that, to be quite funny, but we're going to give our famous quiz to Robbie now.
Should I be worried here? I am a little bit.
I think you'll be quite good at this. But who's winning at the moment? We've got 2 with 5, haven't we?
Still Lucas, no?
Yeah. And didn't Alan Kennedy get 5 out of 6?
That's got to be a fix if you got
that. James was very kind with him on the call of questions. Do you know why 6 questions, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you know why it's 6 questions?
Yeah, well, obviously the opening cup to
it. Ah, well, see, that's
the first one. No, James is the quiz master. So.
Oh, shit, you're cramped. Oh, my God. Yeah, no more.
Yeah, did you talk?
Can't reach that.
It's been a long podcast. Yeah. Number one. Against which club did you score the most goals during your Liverpool career? 14 it was, if that helps.
Oh, God. I mean, it's either Arsenal or Aston Villa.
Correct. It's one of those two.
Aston, or league goals?
Just goals in total.
I'll go Aston Villa.
Correct.
Nice. Yep.
Oh, good start.
Number two, how many England caps did you win?
Oh, shit.
You should know.
Do you want multiple choice?
Oh, no. It's either 26 or 27.
Correct.
Correct.
Shit. 26.
Correct.
Ah, nice.
Right. On to number three.
2 out of 2.
You're 7th on the all-time list of Liverpool goal scorers. Who is just above you in 6th place? So you got 183. This guy got 186.
It's Stevie, you know.
Correct. Yeah. Number four.
Fucking hell, you got 3 out of 3.
Honestly. How many times were you sent off for Liverpool?
Oh. I didn't even know that.
Twice.
Correct.
Jesus. I think we're onto something.
He's flying.
Bolton and Everton.
Number five.
No, extra point for that one, though.
who did you come on for against Alaves in the 2001 UEFA Cup final?
Oh, God, you threw me there. I was hoping you were going to say who to come on for in the in my first game back. I think I've come on. Right, Alaves.
I think if you get this one, I think you might get the 6 out of 6, the first one, mate. You know,
I
know.
I mean, you want to give us a clue for that one? I think
too much at stake. No, there's too much at stake. No.
I mean, you know, when we talked about coming on again, that's not happening now. Like, if there's too much at stake, you know what I mean? I mean, you've got to like. Can we come back to that?
Sure.
Go on, okay. Yeah, right. Go ahead, then.
And the number six is. Against which club did you score your last goal for Liverpool?
Oh, that's Sheffield United.
Correct.
Oh, now this is
for the
to be crowned.
The one got 6 out of 6.
Oh, well, listen, I'm going to be top, aren't I, on Kaufbach?
First ever 6 out of 6 at stake. There's only a couple that it can be, really, in 3.
I've got an MLS game ahead. I've got Emileski in my head.
I
think it's Emileski, but...
No, it's not.
What?
It is.
Yeah. What are you doing? 6 out of 6.
Well done.
6 out of 6. Well done.
Top.
Well, that's the end of the podcast. It's been brilliant. Great to see you, pal.
Pleasure, mate.
Thank you for coming on, Robbie.
Pleasure, thank you.
Great to see you, pal.
Brilliant. Cheers, thank you very much.
Cheers, everyone.